thing. I think it, you know, they don't want to say lots of jobs are going to be cut because it's not a nice PR thing. But I appreciate the candor, and I actually think it's better for employees anyway to know what's going on. Personally, I think, you know, if you're going to do this, it's better to be upfront and honest with the wider. Well, this is one of the reasons I quite like him. I quite like Pekka Lundmark because I think he's quite sort of direct about what he's trying to do.
Hello and welcome to another telecoms.com podcast. The day looks half decent today, although it's been shite all week. And today's the day I don't walk the dog. I normally walk the dog. My sort of routine is get all the writing and editing done, get a newsletter out about 2 o'clock, get out walking a dog about 2:30 or 3. And every day this week, it's just been gloomy and spitting and just generally...
Do you know, I haven't left the house this week.
You literally haven't left the house?
No.
Aren't you doing your runs anymore?
I've got tendonitis. I've had it for 2 weeks. I can't. If I go walking, probably, yeah. But it's really painful.
The cool thing is I sometimes get tendonitis from doing fuck all. Don't know what that's all about.
But as a result, I haven't even gone outside.
Actually, which tendon? Is it your Achilles?
It's my left. No, it's on the other side. The one that goes across the front of the foot.
Okay, so, and it's just really sore.
Hmm. I've had it before there, so I know it's tendonitis because you can't go to the doctor these days, of course. But
doctors can't do anything for tendonitis. They just sort of go.
No,
cheer
they
up.
Give you some anti-inflammatories and just say don't do anything. So that's what I've done.
And I go. I'm miles ahead of you, doc. What, you're gonna prescribe beer and computer games next? Right. So what has been going on this week? I think we're going to go back to Nokia again because they've been unveiling their cunning plan to do better. Mm-hmm. And we'll have a look at quite how cunning or not that plan is. Then I think we can talk about patents, mainly from a Huawei point of view. They had this event and a white paper and stuff going, we really respect intellectual property, definitely. There's nothing more important to us than a good bit of intellectual property. And it's just like, all right, fair enough, Huawei, we get it. And I'm going to look at why they might have laboured that point and perhaps sort of patents in general. And then we conclude we had another Spectrum auction this week, which went very quickly. It was sort of one of the less, there was less fanfare about it than normal, but there was some decent Spectrum kicking about. So we'll look at who won what, why we should care, and Spectrum auctions in general. Mm-hmm. And then depending on whether we got time or not, I've got something we can argue toss about for 5 or 10 minutes to do with net neutrality and zero rating, which I just wrote this morning. But we'll see how we do for time. So Nokia. All right, I'm going to start with we're basically talking about their Capital Markets Day. Although I wrote like at least a couple of Nokia bits this week. And
well, they came out with a big announcement before the Capital Markets Day, really, didn't they?
What was that? Why don't you remind me? Because I'm being disorganized.
So,
and shit.
So the Capital Markets Day was set up to be like the sort of next stage of the plan. You know, Pekka Lundmark, their new CEO, took over in August, came in, you know, said what he was going to do different because they're in a bit of a fix at the moment with various things that have gone wrong. And, you know, that sort of prompted the departure of Rajiv Suri. So he's come in August. He set out a few ideas, done a bit of restructuring, and then promised a proper update in March with the next kind of phase. And the really big announcement actually came out before the Capital Markets Day, which is this sort of heavy cost-cutting plan, which I don't think was unexpected. I mean, I've been asking Nokia about this, what they're going to do on the cost side, because it seemed like they needed to do more there, you know, if they're going to put money into research and development, which has kind of fallen in the last 3 years. So it wasn't unexpected, but it's pretty upfront. It's funny because, you know, Nokia in the past has actually been cutting lots of jobs anyway, you know, but you don't know about it unless you sort of make the effort to go through their annual reports. They don't even say in quarterlies. And,
well, it's a tough one to make a press release about, isn't it? Like, your press release
it,
going,
it is, but I appreciate
bunch of fuckers on the dull.
It's not nice. But this is the thing. I think they don't want to say lots of jobs are going to be cut because it's not a nice PR thing. But I appreciate the candor, and I actually think it's better for employees anyway to know what's going on. Personally, I think, you know, if you're going to do this, it's better to be upfront and honest with the wider. Well, this is one of the reasons I quite like him. I quite like Pekka Lundmark because I think He's quite sort of direct about what he's trying to do.
There's a bit of a tangent about that. There was, you know, the Huffington Post. Mm-hmm. It was bought by Verizon, and then they flogged it to BuzzFeed. And BuzzFeed's having to let loads of people go because most of these woke publications like Huffington Post aren't making any money.
Yeah.
But apparently, I was just reading, I think on Twitter, that they got a bunch of people in and then went, right, unless you hear from us, you're gone. Or if you don't hear from us, you're gone. Some really sort of harsh, impersonal, cold way. Anyway, so, again, back to
the operators, the European operators, I mean, you know, because I chat about this all the time, and I have a spreadsheet that has job numbers in it, and they're mass. I mean, AT&T and Verizon have hacked loads of jobs in the US over the last few years, and yet they don't come out with announcements and they don't talk about it. It just sort of we're trying to save this much money, and then you have to sort of go through the reports and you write about. I get quite our stories. I know from not looking at the metrics, but talking to my editor, the ones that on jobs tend to get quite a lot of
page views
because the companies don't say it themselves. I think it's one of the reasons, and it's not widely reported on.
So it'd be people within the company itself clicking on your stories to find out what's going on.
Yeah, and I suppose people who've been laid off obviously know they've been laid off, but they're not going to the press and talking about it because whenever I write these things, I often find I'm the first person to have written anything about AT&T's job cuts And there's sort of, then AT&T gets in touch and goes, oh, you know, hang on a minute, we are still recruiting as well. And they get all upset about it. And,
if they bother to actually communicate with you on the subject, I mean, this is a bugbear of mine. The way, you know, and this isn't to in any way diminish your achievements of being first, but of course, if the journalistic world was more healthy, you'd like to think other people would cover these things too.
You would. And in a way, I'm glad they don't because it gives me something to do where I can say I'm coming out with something first.
Yeah, and we're
first,
lucky to have journalistic jobs. Just ask Huffington Post.
Yeah.
But I think that's even less excuse for companies to not engage with us, given that there's a diminishing number of us. The only time they engage is when you write something they don't like, and that's just shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted.
Yeah.
You know, if they just invested a little bit more on just having in-house PR people who bother to get to know you, they don't have to take us out and get us pissed like the good old days. Although, believe me,
hang on a minute,
I'm not against that. I'm just saying it's not a stipulation. They could at least just get in touch once a week, going, all right, how's it going?
They could always send some beers around.
You what?
Send some beers around. You know, we're always up for a bribe of the week, aren't we?
Yes, which I haven't been able to talk about bribe of the week again. My own limited resources have gone into this. How many bottles of this have you got in?
Well, I'm on the smaller bottle at the moment. It's the sort of half size of yours, but I've got a lot of them. There's about 30 in the fridge.
But they're not 30 daddy ones. So that's fifteen of my ones.
Yeah,
fair enough.
And apparently, there's more turning up tonight.
Excellent. Just
I don't know what's going on. I don't know what, because I didn't order them. My other half did. So I don't know why
she's
done
just
that.
Decided you've been a good hubby.
Must have done something good around the house, maybe.
That's just a bit of a tangent that, you know, when they get in touch and have a moan after you've written something, whereas they could preempt a lot of those stories or at least engage with you.
Yeah.
So Nokia announced these job cuts. As you say, that was fairly predictable, because then they had this Capital Markets Day, and I'll get into my coverage there, because basically the premise of the job cuts is we've fallen behind a little bit on 5G, and the only way we're going to pick it up again is to spend more on research and development.
That's the main premise.
And so I did a bit of a back of the fag packet thing. They reckon that once they've axed all these extra people, that'll save them a further 600 million euros a year. Mm-hmm. But then I looked at your coverage that you've done of Nokia quite recently, where they're over the last couple of years, they've reduced their R&D spend by about 750 million a year anyway. So these, even when these job cuts kick in, which won't be for 2 or 3 years, the money they'll get from that, even if they invest all of it back into R&D, they're still going to struggle to get back to like 2018 levels when they do it. So it just, the maths on that didn't end up. And then on top of that, they expect to increase their margin, their profitability. And I understand it's moving in the right direction, partly because, again, as you covered in that same story, they've already laid off about the same amount of people over the last couple of years as they intend to in the next couple of years. And partly because they've been repairing some of the damage that done with their miscalculation, especially over FPGA chips as opposed to ASIC chips, which sort of damaged their competitiveness. But I'm just thinking, okay, so you're going to spend more on R&D, you're going to increase your profitability. They're also thinking of restoring the dividend, mm-hmm. which is basically a straight transfer of cash flow from the company to its shareholders. And I just don't see where this money is coming from. It strikes me that they need, you know, and they expect to, I think in their little table, they said they expect to outgrow the market. So they expect to be better than Ericsson and Huawei, where Huawei is allowed to compete with them, where they're currently not. So that would seems to me it require a hell of a lot more R&D spend that they're going to acquire from these redundancies. Does that all make sense to you?
Yeah, I kind of agree on the R&D part of it, and I'm a bit more optimistic than I was on the margin side of it. So I think you make a really valid point on R&D. I think they were spending about 4.8 billion euros a couple of years ago, I think was the sort of annual spend. You got 2 or 3 years, and it's come right down to about 4.1. So they've made, and I've written about this before, that this sort of deterioration in R&D spend is a bit of a worry when Ericsson and Huawei are actually increasing what they're spending. And I remember asking Rajiv Suri about it actually when I managed to get an interview with him, and he was sort of saying, well, we can focus it on certain areas and we've realized efficiencies by, you know, using lower cost resources
thing.
In Poland or whatever, and all this stuff. But
that's what politicians say when they say they're going to spend money on public resources, on public services, but we're not going to raise taxes. They go, so where are you getting the money from? They go, efficiencies, isn't it?
Yeah. So I take the point that, and they didn't, and I asked the CEO this yesterday when there was a sort of reporter's call with him, and he didn't really answer it, but I did sort of say it only sort of gets you back, which is the point you've made to me. I was sort of nicking your question there, Scott, but I said, it only really gets you back to where you were. And
did you nick that question off Scott? He sounds like kind of shit he'd ask.
He didn't really answer it. He was, because he sort of answered it by talking about margins, basically, as people do sometimes. But I don't know. I mean, in fairness to them, they've even though the R&D spend has come down, I think what's happened is they've tried to sort of focus it on the areas where they've been struggling. So they have actually increased spending on the 5G side of things. Yeah. Now, it's not very clear they've done that because of the structure of the business at the moment, but that will become a lot more transparent with this new structure where mobile basically gets split off and it will have its own R&D line. So you will be able to see exactly what's going on. And I think they have already been putting more money in that area. So, and the thing is that it has brought results. I mean, these mistakes that happened, which we've talked about loads of times, using FPGAs on the kind of radio side rather than the kind of customized silicon that Huawei and Ericsson do, had really kind of tripped them up. But they are dealing with that. I mean, they're already at, I think, 40% of the products now don't have those FPGAs in them. And they're hoping
and
to
finish
that transition.
That still gets filed under undoing a mistake.
Yeah, it's undoing a mistake. So it doesn't get you, that's the thing, I suppose. It doesn't get you leadership, but it certainly deals with that big problem. And if you look at what's happened on the margin side of things, there's a huge improvement in the gross margin in networks, which is due to that transition. One of the problems with these FPGAs is that they're very costly. You know, ASICs become a lot more, from what I've heard from talking to semiconductor people, is ASICs become a lot more kind of cost efficient and when you get high volumes, which is what these companies are trying to do. And therefore, by phasing them out and bringing in the ASICs, they've given a massive boost to their gross margins. So on the side where you're talking about these targets, I'm not sure. I think, you know, everything's got to work quite well for it to play out. But I don't think it's ludicrous. I mean, the margin they're at the moment, this last year, you've got to remember, was 10%. Okay, yeah. It was 9.7 exactly, I think. So if they're saying this year 7 to 10, I mean, let's assume they only come in at 7. That's a drop of about 3 percentage points anyway. With sales, the forecast for sales is down a bit, but not massively. And their gross margins have been going up all the time, quarter on quarter, because of this ASICs transition they're making. So I can see...
And the ongoing redundancies.
Well, the redundancies won't save them any money. That's the thing.
No,
that's
but it'll because, help with margin.
Well, this program won't help with margin, though, will it? Because everything they save is going to get replowed back into R&D. Yeah. That's the point. But they don't have to save money if they can, you know, if they can use that to prop up R&D, and they get the gross margin improvements that they're getting from this sort of product improvement.
Right. And so, yeah, gross margin is before then, you
then
get into
they only really need costs. They can even allow the margin to go down. 7% is a dip, but that might happen. But it's still. I think it's achievable. I think
but they want it more like 13% in
well,
a couple 10, of years.
It's 10 to 13. So again, bottom end of the range is only what the thing they haven't done is provide a clear. I mean, the sales forecast is interesting because this year they're talking about a bit of a dip, and then 2022 I think is the year when they're saying they want to start to perform better, and 2023 kind of outperforming the market. So it's all got to go well, and these R&D investments in 5G and other areas have got to pay off. But the thing I mean, there's a couple of things that are working well for them at the moment, I think, after a really bad 2020 when they lost a deal with Verizon, basically, or they didn't win a deal that and ended up going to Samsung. Mm-hmm. And they also had this big setback in China because they didn't pick up any of the 5G contracts. Now, on the China side of things, I did write a story last night about Nokia in China because that was one of the things that I asked the CEO about, and he talked about a bit, you know, do you want to, what are your ambitions for China? And he's basically a bit gung-ho about China. He's like, you know, we didn't have a very good product set before, and that's the reason we lost work, and Ericsson sort of picked it up. We're in a much better position now. The interesting thing is China's phase two is about to get, you know, they always do this time of year. They hand out the big contracts. They did this big 700,000 base station build last year. The all eyes now are on what those companies are going to do this year in terms of the next stage of the build out, which is, from talking to people, it sounds like it's going to be more of a kind of coverage-based thing rather than massive MIMO in cities, which is what they've been doing. It's getting sort of 700 megahertz spectrum out, looking at the countryside. So who knows? With all this, we've talked about this before, Ericsson's issues about, you know, what the Swedish government's done with the ban on Huawei in Sweden.
And you mentioned
Sweden.
That in your piece.
Mentioned that in my piece.
You sort of shoehorned it in. Made for a juicy headline.
And why not? Why? It's not inconceivable, and I've heard rumours anyway that Nokia maybe gets a look in for the phase two stuff, and Ericsson doesn't. You know, I mean, it's very hard to see them kind of replacing Huawei or ZTE, isn't it? They always pick up the kind of lion's share of the work in China, but you could see Nokia coming in. Or 5% each to the Nordic ones, or maybe one of them, you know, maybe Ericsson not getting stuff because it's like, well, we're, you know, slap your wrist.
I'd be surprised actually if the Chinese government missed the opportunity to give Sweden a bit of a slap.
Yeah. So that's one thing which would work very, very well for not in terms of how, you know, what that market has done for Ericsson in the last year. That would be very, very helpful. And then I think the other thing is they're doing reasonably well in Europe. You know, they are winning work now that there's this kind of backlash against Huawei, and a couple of governments have decided that you can't use Huawei in your 5G network anymore. They are doing quite well in the European region. So there are a few things that are going quite well for them. The enterprise side is quite strong. They've always been good in optical and IP. There's never been an issue there anyway, really. So I don't know. I think things have to go smoothly.
And you actually listened in on the Capital Markets Day, whereas I just
listened to most of it.
I didn't
spend all 4 hours.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's a couple of deals even this week that are worth flagging up for Nokia. They got a global self-organizing network deal with Orange Group.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how much that's worth, but it's better than a kick in the unmentionables, isn't
it? I mean, the funny thing about the headcount chopping, and I think one possible concern is, you know, how low can you go without – it's not all R&D, is it? You know, it's all very well saying, oh, we're going to put more people in R&D. We're going to have, like, thousands and thousands of R&D people, and we're not going to have that much in other areas. But businesses need more than just R&D. You need a good sales team, clearly. You need a good – marketing function. You need all sorts of people to run a business. And there's always a concern when companies start chopping headcount that you start to lose a bit of competitiveness.
And it will have been about 20% down over 4 years.
It's down a lot. So the last 2 years, they've cut a lot. After the Alcatel-Lucent deal, they didn't. They were quite bloated in a way for a while. And then all of a sudden, the last 2 years, headcount's come down a lot. It's about 11,000.
Do you reckon a lot of it's come out of the Alcatel-Lucent side? Probably.
You'd sort of think so. I mean, there was quite a lot of overlap, I think, in the on the mobile side, wasn't there, with that merger. And nothing seemed to happen on the headcount side at first. But then the last 2 years, I mean, they've been under pressure to reduce costs for margin purposes anyway. So they did say, I mean, this is where he's more transparent than his predecessor, because they build the last cost-cutting scheme just as we need to get 500 million euros off the accounts each year. They didn't actually attach a headcount figure to it. But then you look at the annual reports and you can see headcounts dropped a lot. And it's a lot. It's more than Lundmark's talking about now. He's talking about 5,000 to 10,000 in 2 years. They've already done 11 in two. Yeah. So, but I just think, you know, if you add that all up, that 11,000, if it's 10,000 he gets rid of, that's 21,000 people, you know. And when Ericsson had its big sort of downsizing, when Ekholm came in, it was accompanied by selling a lot of assets, wasn't it? They got rid of quite a lot of businesses, and that's why I think a lot of jobs disappeared. Whereas he's not talking about doing that. There's no sense at the moment that he wants to quit Optical or get out of, you know,
no
fixed broadband, God, or whatever it might
if they
be.
Quit Optical.
I mean, it's inconceivable, isn't it? That's why I always thought it was unlikely that he would sell any assets, actually. Because,
well, yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, I said my headline, that was skeptical about the numbers was, Nokia's cunning plan to outgrow the market just doesn't add up, and I sort of covered all the numbers that we've just gone over.
Yeah.
But there, you know, there were some quotes from it. Oh yeah, this is one quote. So this wasn't me listening in like you did. This is just the canned quote from the press release. Pekka Lundmark stuff. He goes, "We have moved away from end to end as a cornerstone of our equity story."
Yeah.
And that is basically a euphemistic way of saying the whole point of the Alcatel-Lucent acquisition turned out to be bollocks.
Yeah.
Because that was all about end-to-end, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. I mean, he was pretty upfront about that as soon as he joined.
I mean, it's not his fault.
And I guess
it's still a sort of depressing admission.
There's nothing wrong with having a big business that can do lots of different things. And, you know, perhaps there are times when the market's not so good for mobile, but it's really good for IP, and it's nice to be in those. And there are some companies that will want to buy end-to-end. And also, I still think the point's valid that if you've got a good customer relationship with someone based on mobile, then you're in a good position for selling broadband.
And vice versa.
So I think he's saying end-to-end doesn't really work in the way I think that Rajiv Suri had it in mind, where it was all important and it was all about that's
and
how
we sell people
want to
these
buy.
Complete all-encompassing packages.
That's not how they want to do things. They want to do what's it called, best of suite rather than best of breed, basically, I think is the expression. But
okay,
best of breed being you kind of look at a whole package and think, well, the whole package is better than another company's whole package. And
I'm going to go all in on Nokia.
You dip into bits and try and assemble something from different people.
No, well, but especially when you look at how things are going with things like Open RAN.
It doesn't really play to the whole the conversation that's happening in the industry, that whole end-to-end stuff, which I think was why it was always a bit dubious. But, I mean, my issue is he's not talking about selling assets at the moment, and yet he's talking about getting rid of a huge number of people on top of the amount they've already lost. And you just sort of think to yourself, do they at some point run into problems because they've got rid of, because they're not actually that, and 80 to 85,000 would be a lot less than Ericsson, I think, is at about 100,000 at the moment after a couple of acquisitions with this German antenna business they bought. They've gone back up a little bit. So, and they're only mobile, and they've got 100,000 employees. If you look at it on a revenues per employee basis, I think Nokia makes more money than Ericsson does. It's more sort of efficient on that
particular
measure.
You're saying it's already pretty bloody lean.
So it's already quite lean, really. Yeah.
And as you say, I just wonder. It's involved in more areas as well.
Yeah. So I just wonder whether it's, you know, he seems to think that they can do it, you know, and I agree with some of his points about there were too many people probably in the global management team. There were too many sort of overlapping interests there. And this end-to-end thing actually forced you to involve lots of people at the table, you know, and have conversations with lots of people. And maybe they can realise some efficiencies and job cuts through just streamlining some
of
that.
Yeah, I think a new CEO definitely opens new opportunities for streamlining as well. Because a new CEO can come in and sort of clean house at the C-suite a bit, can't they?
Yeah.
Whereas I think it's pretty hard when you've been there for a while. It's pretty hard to get rid of other big beasts.
Well, that's when these teams change, isn't it? You know, the CFO's changed as well as various other people, and it's just a new team, basically. Really, I mean, there are some
Marcus Weldon went, and he's to me is the sort of face of the. Well, that was the Lucent side a lot.
That was the one that really surprised me, I have to say, out of the cuts and the people that left. I was a bit stunned that Marcus Weldon went, because, you know, you want to keep your best people, presumably. And anybody I talk to in the industry calls him out as like a, it's not all about having a big brain, you know, and being a very smart thinker, but he was respected among very smart thinkers as being somebody who's super
brainy
bright
dude. And he was probably their best public communicator as well.
Yeah, he was good at that. So I was a little bit surprised that
Ray was used to asking about Man U and stuff, didn't he?
Yeah, he probably did, yeah. I only ever interviewed him a couple of times, but he's
a good lad, though, isn't he? He's quite relaxed, quite articulate. Yeah.
I don't know what he's doing now, actually, but he could probably do anything he wanted, really.
He's probably got some lab in his basement where he just invents stuff. Every now and then you hear see flashes and explosions.
Like
and he
weird
comes
science
up
or something.
With singed eyebrows going, I've just invented a mobile phone pigeon or something. Okay, but I think your point's well made. You can only streamline so much.
You can, and I'm more sort of upbeat about the margin side of it, really, because I don't think they're almost saying, you know, worst case scenario, things just stay flat, you know, this sort of 10% level for the next few years.
But not if they spend as much as they should be on R&D. That's my point. They should be, you know, that's the other question that I remember whispering in your ear before you went on the call. Is like, why don't you get a Lindmark and go, how about you just have no margin this year, no profit? Blow the lot.
Well,
R&D.
I asked him that. I said,
buy
would
a bunch
you,
of test tubes. And I said, would you?
Well, I said, is the 7% sacrosanct, or would you consider going below that to invest more in R&D? And that was a question he didn't really answer. He just sort of said, but he did answer it by saying it is sacrosanct. They don't want to go below 7%. That's a firm target. That he did answer that side of it.
Well, yes. I mean,
he said if that to change, they'd have to change something else, he said. So they'd have to come up with some update where they did what you said and they go, we're going to invest $1 billion in R&D.
Yeah, and a lot of that is just proper due process. They can't go to all the trouble of making these big presentations where we're aiming for 7 to 10. And the moment some smart ass goes, how about go and learn that? Go, yeah, all right. Yeah, why not?
Exactly. I mean, they've got to give certainty to investors and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing that's worth pointing out about them is, like Ericsson, they were in a really good balance sheet position, those two companies. You know, we talk about the European operators have got like so much debt, it's unbelievable. They've got more debt than they're worth. They've got loads of cash. They're in a really good cash position.
Below that, then.
Yeah, well, they were asked by Bloomberg, actually, was asking them about raising debt to pay for extra research and development. And there's kind of no need, but they didn't sort of want to dip in. It's almost like they want to maintain that healthy cash position because they're just kind of quite prudent, I guess, and careful and you know.
Well, there we are. So I think that's where we have the essence. Whether the money's raised from cash reserves, from debt, from redundancies, from efficiencies, they pretty much said themselves, we've got to spend a lot more cash on R&D. And if I was an investor, and I am to the tune of a tenner, which is only worth about £7 now, by the way, that's £3 you owe me, Pecker. If I was an investor, I'd still be thinking, well, I'm just not sure where you're going to suddenly go from being behind the market in 5G technology to ahead of it. It's just hard to see that process.
Yeah.
But, you know, good luck to them. We certainly need them to be competitive.
I think there are areas they're already good in. That's the thing. They're already recognized as being good in some areas of mobile. It's the specific problem they had, which was a bad problem because it meant your products are basically less competitive, you know, and they're not as energy efficient from what I've heard talking to people about FPGAs. And that was, you know, that was called out, you know, a couple of years ago. And there's been a lot of attention focused on it, partly by us. But, you know, if they can deal with that, then I think there's other parts of the mobile network side of things where they actually do very well. You know, they have very good performance metrics on other areas. It's just this terrible mistake they made, it seems in retrospect now, by the using FPGAs was
something that's really cost them a lot.
I think catching up on that, it's not like they're rubbish in all areas. There's 5G is very complicated, and so is 4G. There's lots of different areas to it and aspects to it. So I don't think it's fair to say just because of this FPGA issue that they're kind of crap in mobile generally.
Do you have any sense of whether if it's possible to isolate it, whether the core RAN proposition by Nokia is considered on a par with the core RAN proposition from Ericsson and Huawei?
Well, that's a good question for them. I'm supposed to speak with the head of mobile I think the market would say they're perceived to be a bit the market.
Well, they just got
that
deal with
AT&T
for their C band.
Yeah,
I mean that's an endorsement of their RAN.
It is, but I think probably the FPGA thing's quite important on that side, my perspective, that's made them not as competitive as Ericsson and Huawei.
Once they sort that out, so to simplify it, and then I'm going to move on, we're saying that once they've sorted out the FPGA thing, they're back to parity with Ericsson, and then the plan is to push on from there and in some ways outcompete.
Back to parity on that side of things. But then, as I say, they've got other things. Like, for instance, one thing they made quite a big deal of on the call, not a massive deal, actually. I did ask him a bit about it, was Open RAN. You know, where they're pushing that a lot more heavily than Ericsson is.
They seem to be, don't they?
Nokia. Now, Open RAN, I mean, I said to the CEO, aren't you a bit worried about Open RAN? Because it's perceived to be a big risk by some people. You know, you're going to let lots of other companies come into the market. And he said, we can't possibly not do something because we're worried about competition in future if we think that's where the market's
totally
going,
right.
Which is a really sensible answer. You know, it's like,
it's the only way.
Like Kodak,
I mean,
saying,
you know, otherwise you're being Kodak, not.
Yeah,
not
you're like being Kodak and,
cameras.
Oh, well, this is not what we do. And you know, so maybe this will all work out really well for them, that they're, because they're much more eager, it seems, to adapt their product and try and show willing with the Open RAN movement, that they'll end up landing a lot of business that Ericsson won't. And they'll be in a much better situation. I mean, I'm a bit skeptical about some sides of Open RAN and about how quickly it can move and whether it's really going to deliver all the benefits it does. But one thing I've said in articles that I've written is I think a lot of the work, you know, they're pitching this as a way to get smaller companies into the market and alternatives. And there's a good chance that if the big vendors move well enough, they just end up winning the Open RAN deals anyway. And maybe this is a way for Nokia to kind of restore itself and, you know, and overtake Ericsson in the future. I don't know.
We'll see. That's certainly something we're going to bang on about. In fact, I should flag up that we just created O-RAN as a main subject category on telecoms.com.
Go on, do it.
Because we talk about it and write about it so much. It's not going to go away, is it?
No.
So, all right. Yeah. Cool. All right, I'll move it on. So Huawei, I wrote a... Let me fire it. You see, if I was more organized, I'd be multitasking. And while we're talking, I'd be flicking through telecoms.com, lining up the next thing so that I could just seamlessly go onto it instead of having to fill the air with about a minute's worth of waffle while I try and find what I've written. But there you go. So I refer to so Huawei came out of this white paper. And again, I'm going to hand over to you in a bit. But did you actually get in on their conference call they did to announce the white paper?
I did.
Yeah, okay. So I'll ask you about that. But let me just tee it up first. So they got this white paper and they had you know, as listeners are probably gathering, Ian is more prepared to put the legwork into actually dialing into presentations and talk to people, whereas I just sit, look at a press release and take the piss out of it. So these are our different styles, and there's no doubt that Ian's is more proper journalism. But there we are. I'd look at their thing, and actually they didn't just provide a press release. There was like a transcript of, there's a couple of lads talking. There was a chief legal officer called Song Liu Ping, and there was the head of their intellectual property rights department, Jason Ding. And their quotes were all like, you know, there's nothing more important to Huawei than intellectual property. God, it's important. And we really respect it. And we certainly would never nick anyone else's. And we don't think anyone should do anything like that. And that's really out of order. Now, I'm not saying that they do or don't do any nicking, but they know that they've got a historical reputation to contend with, alongside the fact that the US has basically decided that its narrative is that any Chinese company is intrinsically dodgy and basically will hand over any intellectual property to the Chinese state whenever it's asked. So you can see why Huawei would want to make a big point about this, especially if we believe what it says, that it doesn't do that. I just think, I don't know, it just always strikes me as a slightly clumsy bit of PR when the narrative and the agenda is as overt as that. Yeah. So, you know, I wasn't skeptical. I'm not calling into question any of their claims, but I just framed it as a charm offensive.
Yeah, I think that's what it was, though, really. I mean, it's hard to know how interesting it is, really. I sort of got...
How was the call, then?
Yeah. Well, the call was very long-winded, and it wasn't uninteresting because there was a long discussion about intellectual property rights and patents, and they actually had people on the, I mean, it's quite, I don't know where they filmed it. It was in Shenzhen, but it was at this place that looked like a kind of stately home in England on the lawn. It's obviously a very sunny day over there with a bunch of journalists and analysts not wearing masks. It all looked like, you know, it was like another planet, really.
Don't get me started on how China seems to be completely over coronavirus.
I mean, and the PR charm tense. Offensive was almost, you know, look how well we've come out of coronavirus. Yeah, we don't even have people wearing masks. It was a long discussion that involved other people who weren't actually at the event in person, but were sort of video conferenced in from other parts of the world, including members of various intellectual property groups and a couple of academics. And there was quite a frank discussion by one of the academics about China's issues in this area in the past and the fact that it's been perceived to be an intellectual property thief and it hasn't done enough to deal with that, and how, you know, he was saying there's still not enough innovation coming out of China, which is quite, I mean, you've got to applaud Huawei for putting somebody like that on the, not on the stage, but on the screen, and, you know, and not sort of trying to silence them, but I think they've learned how proper PR works. Yeah.
You know, I mean, something that I found with some Chinese companies in the past, and probably Huawei is one of them, I mean, I've been dealing with Huawei's PR since before I've even done this job, because I used to cover smartphones, they didn't seem to understand. There was obviously a cultural gulf.
Yeah.
And I don't think culturally they understand quite how obnoxious and off message journalists of which I'm a classic example on the obnoxiousness scale can be here, and how, you know, you can't control us. You can't even necessarily persuade us. All you can do is engage with us and hope that we're going to be even handed. And I always maintain that I'm equally obnoxious to everyone. So maybe they've learned that lesson now.
Maybe.
And that kind of open, you know, they're obviously all about transparency, because what they're accused of is not being transparent.
Yeah.
So, yeah, fair enough. They're trying to be more transparent to prove.
And I think that was the main thing, was to sort of show that they're, you know, to come out with a, they didn't have rates, as you said yourself. It was actually a cap they came out with on the, so it's two, I think it's two.
So that was one of their big claims, wasn't it? Right. So look, we're announcing what our intellectual property, basically what we charge for sort of FRAND 5G patents.
Yeah.
So standard essential patents.
Yeah. In a phone, and so it's capped at 250 in a 5G smartphone, basically.
Yeah.
And then they sort of had a forecast as well of what they're going to make over the 20s. So it's not really a forecast; it's kind of part forecast, part what's happened, what they'll make from 2019 to 2021, which is, I think, $1.3 billion. They were saying
dollars
in sales. So it's less than
it's
less than Ericsson and Nokia make. So Ericsson make, I think Nokia makes about 1.5, I think, in billion euros in brand and patent licensing, and maybe Ericsson's sort of similar from licensing, but and then the rate's a bit lower than Nokia's. I think Nokia's had a cap of €3 a couple of years ago when it published its ones, and obviously then Qualcomm's got much higher rates than anyone. You know,
and it
you
doesn't
end up
publish
paying,
them, does it?
It does publish them. I found them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
About 2.2. It's 2.275% on a sort of multi-mode phone, and I think, and maybe
what,
three
on the
5G one.
So, on the value of the phone. So if it's a phone, costs a grand.
Yeah, it's about 20 quid or something. Yeah, it can be.
Wow.
That's known. I mean, it's quite recognised that you end up paying quite a lot of money,
and they've got the modem and all that.
Yeah, I mean, I talked to some people a bit about this on background, so I can't say who they were, but they're sort of in the intellectual property game, and their perspective is that they can get away with doing it, and it's partly a sort of, there's a bit of sort of financial engineering going on there, because they can get a better sort of rate, I think, in terms of taxes on the licensing revenues they earn than on what they make from chips. They're actually underpricing their chips kind of thing and overpricing their licensing revenues, so you actually get their chips, which are, I think, widely recognized to be the best things you can possibly buy.
Certainly the modems,
They're very reasonably priced, but the downside is where
cheapest
you pay
chips.
Is on cheapest chips, but you pay in these licensing fees. But what it's done is it's exposed them to kind of a lot of litigation.
Well, that's what
over
all
the
Apple
years.
Agro was about, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But they're obviously doing it well, because even Apple, and I bet they're not short of a lawyer or two, Even no, Apple well, couldn't make the charge
they're,
stick.
They're well lawyered up, and they have amazing technology, from my understanding. So, but I think they also have a really strong position on the patent side as well. I mean, I've been told it's not necessarily better than Ericsson and Nokia, but it's good, you know.
And it's different.
And it's, yeah. And this is the other thing, I think, about Huawei. So, again, sort of discussions on background and, you know, but you can read people speculating about this anyway. It's interesting, these patent studies come out, don't they, that try and rank companies in terms of who's got the biggest share of standard essential patents. And, you know, they all seem to disagree.
They just came
with
out with an update this week, wasn't it? Gray something or other?
There's Gray B, there's IPlytics, there's loads of them now, actually.
Oh, this, I saw you quote IPlytics a fair bit.
I did quote IPlytics, but I did a piece before about them generally, about patent studies and how there never seems to be any real consensus, you know, and they're all over the place.
It's really hard to tell, isn't it, who's winning?
And then I chatted to this person on background, who I should say is very much in the patents game, sort of deep in it, but didn't want to be named. And they basically said, it's really, really hard to do. Like, how you measure this stuff and how you actually assess whether a patent is standard essential. It would take 20 hours, they said, to look at one patent and go through it and analyze it properly. And there are thousands of these things,
I covered this a few months ago. I think I was talking to InterDigital. And it was a similar thing. You know, so if something's standard essential, then fine. You can prove it's standard essential because the standard is known and the patents within the standard are known. But then you get the how essential.
Yeah.
And how, you know, how much of the core functionality of 5G is needed by this one patent. So you can have a patent that without which the whole thing will crumble.
Yeah.
And then you could have another patent without which the whole thing would be 1% worse.
And this is the other thing as well, is that what Huawei doesn't have is it's got a very strong position in 5G. But people doubt the quality anyway of some of the stuff that it shouts about.
Spammy.
But it doesn't have legacy stuff. So, and the interesting thing is, a lot of the stuff in 5G is actually redeclared 4G and 3G stuff. You know, the technologies like OFDM, which is one of the underlying sort of things on the radio side, is vital to all those standards, I think. Well, certainly 4G and 5G. So, but they don't have a strong position in 4G. So, I just think that their patent position is quite overstated, I think, sometimes in these studies. And the other thing that's worth saying about those studies is that they all seem to have a sponsor, don't they? They all seem to have somebody shouting them out. You know, there's always like Nokia likes this one and Huawei likes this one and Ericsson likes
this
one.
It's the same
one,
as with like the root metrics and that sort of thing.
Yeah, they all have
Everyone's got their favorite network.
I mean, it's not maybe not as overt as this was sponsored by Huawei, but there's certainly as soon as it comes out, they've almost got the story before the press release has gone out, and you kind of think, well,
Well, I mean, it's a bit murky, you know.
Do you know Richard Windsor at Radio Free Mobile? He used to be an analyst at Nomura.
I know
he's very smart.
Of his work. I subscribe to his newsletter. So, but I mean,
he's quite good on this, and he's written a few blogs about it, where he says that people. I mean, one of his conclusions is people don't assess what's essential very well. They kind of consider things to be essential that aren't as essential as other things, if you like.
Well, you get into semantics, don't you?
You do, yeah. But it's one of those really kind of hazy things, and we don't really know.
So that's
what
leads me to be a bit sort of benignly skeptical. You know, and this isn't at Huawei themselves. If Nokia or Ericsson or anyone else decided to do a big press event talking up what a great global citizen they are and how magnanimous they are on intellectual property, I would have exactly the same level of skepticism. It's more skepticism towards the PR set piece, to be honest, even than the subject matter. But then knowing how woolly and fuzzy the whole area is, that makes me even more inclined towards treating it as a charm offensive rather than anything substantial.
Yeah. I think the other thing that's maybe worth noting is that you know, Huawei spends money on you know, it's a licensee as well as a licensor in a way that Ericsson or Nokia isn't. So yeah, because they make smartphones, they have to pay people like Apple and Samsung, for the IP in a way that you don't get that situation in an Ericsson or Nokia these days, because they got rid of their handset businesses a long time ago. So, you know, maybe there's a bit of tit for tat kind of going on. They don't want to come out with outrageous rates, do they? Because other people will start doing that, and then it gets into this,
And that's where a lot of patent stuff, like 10 years ago, something like that, there were companies buying up patents from broken companies like Nortel.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, there's always a degree of asset stripping. Even a company goes down the toilet, it still has assets. And obviously intellectual property is a big one. And people were just buying up chunks of it. It's like pubs that buy books by the meter just to stick on shelves to make themselves look more sort of homely and domestic and all that sort of thing. Yeah. And I realized when I was covering it at the time, it was basically defensive. You know, if someone owns a certain amount of patents, however indifferent they might be about the underlying technology, at the very least, that gives them a defense against sort of patent trolling and more sort of predatory attempts to shake them down. Because they then go, all right, you shake me down, I'll shake you down. See, you fucking like that.
I think that's entirely what it is. And I think a lot of the litigation that happens is you need to have a strong patents portfolio yourself to be able to go into those kinds of battles and actually sort of fight them. And, you know, I think that's what a lot of this is about. The rates, I mean, it's interesting, the rates and the caps, you know, a lot of the time, I think these things actually get resolved just by pure cross-licensing. You know, Huawei will say to Samsung, well, you know, you don't pay us anything, but we don't pay you anything, and it all kind of cancels out, you know. And if it's roughly often a happens. Similar volume of business, then that's fine. But, you know, but
yeah, and you've got FRAND. I mean, in standard pay...
Well, it's all supposed to be FRAND. Yeah, it's all supposed to be FRAND.
Sort of fair and non-discriminatory and all that sort of thing. Basically, an underlying set of principles that says... If you're going to be standard essential, you can't take the piss and hold everyone to ransom.
Which is kind of curious in the context of Qualcomm, isn't it? With its, because they're obviously out there compared to everybody else, it seems. You know, all the rest you're talking about paying, you know, Nokia's saying three, Huawei's saying 250. You have to assume that levels are similar.
But I wonder how much of what you pay Qualcomm is for standard essential patents as opposed to, you know, proprietary clever modem.
Maybe. Yep. It's true.
Okay, so that's that, and of course, all these patents are ultimately designed. Well, a hell of a lot of it is designed to make good use of spectrum. So the whole business we're in, mobile communications, basically involves beaming, initially voice, and now pretty much entirely data over the air. And there's just all manner of cleverness, all these acronyms. All these duplexing and all that sort of stuff that has to go on. But ultimately you need the spectrum. And so we had this week in the UK, we had another spectrum auction, which almost went under my radar, actually. There was so little fanfare about it.
Yeah.
And yet it's quite a big deal, spectrum auction. There's two distinct chunks, basically at the two extreme ends of what might be used like for 5G now. There was a mid-band end, and the higher level of that mid-band end, about 3.8 gigahertz, was it?
Yes, 3.6 to 3.8.
Yeah. And then at the other end, there's this 700 megahertz, which is very useful, and they got it off broadcasting. It had been used by TV companies and radio companies and stuff for years, and Ofcom spent about a decade going, oh, go on, hand it over. And they had to find some way of them getting compensated and all that sort of thing. Anyway, eventually got it off them. And, you know, and this is very useful spectrum because anything under 1 gigahertz has got really good range, really good wall penetration. It's just more effective spectrum. And so both of those got auctioned off in the UK, and they'd set a sort of 1 billion quid or 1.1 billion quid reserve price. In other words, if we don't hit that, no one's getting shit.
Yeah.
You know, which immediately, I know both you and I pretty much agree with each other on this, immediately gets you thinking about sort of state governmental avarice and how, you know, that they're always looking to, it seems, to get as much money transferred from private telecoms companies into state pockets as they can.
Yeah, well, the operators in this case, a couple of them had asked not to have an auction this time and to sort of do it through an administrative fee, but Ofcom turned around and said no.
Mm. And furthermore, we want at least 1.1 bill. We're not getting out of bed. Must cost a lot to run Ofcom, don't you think?
Well, I think partly they're just, you know, they couldn't be fucked, but yeah, if they... if they don't get the money, then what happens to Ofcom? That presumably pays the wages, doesn't it, at Ofcom?
But
spectrum auctions? I mean, where else is the money coming from?
They ended up getting $1.36 billion.
Yeah.
You know, how many people does Ofcom employ?
Yeah, well, you think about what they have made over the last 20 years.
Exactly. There's no way all of that just sloshes around Ofcom.
Well, I don't think it does.
I mean, 10% of it does, and the rest of it just goes into the pot. And God knows we need it.
The pot's a big pot at the moment, isn't it, with not a lot of change in it. But you go back to the, I think, the turn of the century when they had the 3G auction, which is a really outrageous one. I think Gordon Brown just went off on a big sort of public sector spending spree, didn't he, after that.
Well, I think he was going to do it anyway, but that certainly helped.
It helped.
Probably made him feel even more like, yes, a billion here, a billion there.
Just get telecoms to pay for everything that you possibly can.
Yeah, exactly.
Up and down the country. And
yes. So they ended up getting $1.36 billion. So I thought, well, I'll hand over to you in a sec, because your piece was quite sort of ranty about the sums of money involved and all that sort of thing. At least they managed to keep it not too far over the reserve price. But, you know, over to you. What did you have to say about it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just increasingly sceptical of the auction process, to be honest, in Europe. And I know this is, I mean, it's very cheap compared to what people have spent in the past. In fact, Spectrum's probably never been cheaper in the UK. You look at, as I say, back 3G days when they spent 22.5 billion, and then it was down to 2.5 billion, I think, when they had the 4G auction. And the last two have been 1.4. I mean, if you put those together, then it's 2.8 for 5G spectrum, but it's still a lot less than, you know, than has been spent in the past. And I think in a way it's a sad thing for the industry, because it kind of shows that I think value is diminished, doesn't it, really? You know, they spent so much on 3G partly because they expected it to be. Well, everybody got very excited about 3G as a technology that would deliver another kind of mobile revolution for the operators after the first revolution of voice, which had allowed them to go off and take over the world, you know, and expand into South America. They thought they were going to get the same thing again. And turns out people didn't want to spend more money than what they were already spending.
We really missed the boat when it comes to being journalists. If we're journalists 20 years ago, it'd just be...
I was working on Spectrum auctions then.
Where were you?
I was doing 3G bid book applications and stuff like that.
Okay, so did you? Was it as an analyst or a journalist?
I was for an analyst company, right. But I was in a kind of editorial role.
Am I right in generalising about how the spend on public relations in general was a lot higher back then than it is now?
Yeah, I mean, I know people who were in journalism back at the turn of the century, and they all say, you know, those are the boom years. Yeah, I mean, there was the big broadband boom in America as well, when all these companies, like, you know, I mean, some of them are kind of, the leaders of them ended up in jail, didn't they? The MCI WorldComs and all this lot. But there was a lot of excitement about broadband, I think, and dot-coms as well at the same time. And you had this you know, this excitement about telecom that was there in Europe as well. A lot of it, I think, was centered on 3G and the feeling that they were in a position to, you know, to make more of that technology than they actually did. That it would lead to.
Yeah, it coincided with the dot-com bubble as well.
Coincided with the dot-com bubble,
which 3G was expected to sort of exploit.
But I worked on a couple of bid books, which are sort of applications for licenses, you know, that were going on in Europe at the time. And you know, and some of the stuff going into the commercial sections about the kind of services that operators would deliver. I mean, the sort of thing that you see being done now, you know, in terms of video conferencing that people take for granted. But I think the operators thought they were going to play a really fundamental role in delivering it all. And actually all that stuff's gone to the dot-com players, hasn't it?
It's OTTs, not
the OTT. I think partly the you know, the value of 5G spectrum is so much less than the value of 3G, obviously, because... I just think the wind's been knocked out of the market, you know, and people realise now this is not, it's probably not a transformative technology at all, actually. I mean, I know there's still hope that it's going to do something on the enterprise side and lead to all sorts of whizzy new low latency applications, but that remains to be seen.
Well, there's the other thing, like talking about the spectrum itself. So the other part of this auction is we've had the principal stage where everyone bid on stuff. I think O2 and EE both got chunks at both ends, I've actually got my shit together and fired it up this time, having remonstrated myself. whereas Vodafone only went at the high end and Three only went at the low end because they were quite happy.
Yeah, they had a lot anyway, basically.
But now we've got this thing, and I showed you this chart that Ofcom publishes where you can see every little minuscule chunk of spectrum all the way from 791 megahertz all the way up to like 4 gigahertz.
Yeah, it's a good chart, that.
And who's got what. Yeah. And the reason it's relevant is because of the, oh God, what's the word? Contiguous. The word contiguous. In other words, especially for 5G and for higher bandwidths, I mean, as the name implies, you want spectrum that's next to each other. So one big chunk, a 40 megahertz chunk of spectrum is more valuable than two separate 20 megahertz chunks of spectrum. Because then you can create that figurative fatter pipe and have these higher, you know, these higher bandwidths, download speeds, download a HD movie in 1 second and all these sort of things that they like to bang on about. And so what they've done with this auction is they've let everyone bid on little chunks, and then they've all got to go off and barter with each other to try and make sure that everyone ends up with these contiguous bigger chunks, which strikes me as a sort of odd, inefficient or fractious way of doing it. What do you think?
Yeah, well, we talked about this offline, didn't we, earlier in the week? And I think it's a situation that's arisen because they've had two separate auctions, haven't they, in this sort of mid band. So they had their first 5G auction, as I mentioned. I think that also raised about 1.4 billion back in 2018 when they put 3.4 gigahertz up for sale.
Right.
And I can only think that this 3.6 to 3.8 wasn't ready at the time, wasn't available. I don't know, but you know, there's a big argument for trying to do a spectrum auction and include as much in it as possible because it allows companies to plan better and it allows them to get contiguous spectrum. And if you don't do that, then you end up with these sorts of situations. And I think, I mean, maybe this would have happened. Maybe I'm being a bit unfair here because maybe this would have happened anyway. It seems the spectrum that Three UK owns, for instance, is, you know, which it bought from UK Broadband, is all sited sort of in the middle of these two ranges, isn't it? It's sort of between the 3.4 and the 3.6 to 3.8. Well, so the other operators want to get together. Three's kind of standing in the way, preventing them from doing that. But then again, if they do done the two at the same time, it would have probably made it easier for you to get spectrum in a way that, you know, you could, because you could have had companies that only looked at the 3.6 to 3.8 and companies that only looked at the 3.4, if you see what I mean. And then you can get the contiguous blocks. And this is what's probably going to happen now, isn't it? You're probably going to get O2 trying to get BT's 3.4 gigahertz spectrum in exchange for which it gives BT its 3.6 to 3.8.
Exactly. And
I don't know how easy that's going to be.
There were some obvious swaps there.
Well, but I don't know what they hold. This is the thing, why it might be an obvious swap, but I'm not clear. I mean, maybe you've looked at this, Scott, but I'm not clear what they've been given in 3.6 to 3.8.
No, I don't think anyone knows.
And maybe that's flexible because of these chats they want to have about swapping stuff. But if it's not, if they just sort of dish something out, that could make it really complicated to try and come up with an arrangement.
Well, I think what they have to do, so I'm just looking back at what I wrote. Yeah, so I made the point about contiguous spectrum, fat pipes and all that sort of thing. And I said, Three already has a bunch of 3.6 gigahertz spectrum as part of its UK Broadband acquisition. That's why I didn't bother to bid for any more. Where the other three operators sit, we don't know. And it doesn't seem to be relevant. And I said the real business will involve trading existing, which is a point you just made, frequency holdings in order to create bigger contiguous holdings. The obvious deal would involve a swap between EE and O2, such that each gets an 80 megahertz chunk. So as long as one of them ends up with 80 megahertz within the stuff they just bid on, and the other one ends up with 80 megahertz at a slightly lower frequency, but it doesn't really matter.
Well, it's 3.4. Still right up there. It's all mid-band, yeah.
Yeah, it's all the same propagation characteristics, more or less. I mean, there is a directly linear relationship, and the stuff that's higher frequency would be a tiny bit shitter. But I don't know how much. So, that's an obvious thing they can do. But the other problem that creates is because you're having to do deals with your direct competitors in order to do it, you're not just considering what's useful to you. You're also trying to minimize how much use it will be to your direct competitor. So it just creates an odd dynamic, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I just think it's going to be, I mean, that I looked at that particular one that you mentioned, where you can see obviously that it would be good for O2 to get BT spectrum. But because I don't know what the holdings are like in 3.6 to 3.8, it seems like one of those, it might not be an obvious deal that they can do. They might have to sort of get Three and Vodafone around the table all at the same time, you know, in a pub somewhere over a beer and say, look, how the hell do we sort this mess out?
Which is where Ofcom should do its job and mediate and go, right, okay, we guarantee that if you do this, then you won't get fucked in the deal.
Yeah,
it needs arbitration, doesn't it?
It's almost like they can't be bothered. I don't know, but
it's just odd. And everywhere seems to have a slightly different auction mechanism, and it's all really arcane and weird. I mean, the one thing we can say in favour of this auction is not only did people not end up paying much over the reserve price, however ridiculous you think it is that the government should be able to trouser 1.36 billion just for managing some bits of air.
I have an issue with that. I just think at a time like now when operators have come out, they've come out of this pandemic, if we're coming out of the pandemic, they've done pretty well during it compared to some companies, obviously, and they're still, profitable organizations. But, you've seen BT cut its dividend. There are people losing jobs within the operators. Revenues are down. They've lost revenues from roaming, and yet, we've already got corporation taxes going up. They've been warned about that in the next couple of years. You sort of think that they could have, if they're ever going to have a bit of generosity and say now's the time perhaps not to run an auction process, which is complicated and can be expensive, just do what they're asking for and do an applications process where you pay a sort of nominal fee. And it's a bit more like what happens in some Asian countries or even some Scandinavian ones.
Yes.
Why couldn't they have done that? And you look at the letter that Melanie Dawes sent to the operators when two of them asked for this, and one of her justifications was, we can't possibly do that because demand for this spectrum is so great from you and others. Well, who turned up to the auction? The four companies that ran networks.
Yes.
And to call it an auction, when they all pay exactly the same amount for exactly the same band.
That's the other weird thing, wasn't it? How can it be a competitive auction when everyone paid the same? I mean,
it's
there
farcical.
Was one difference. Vodafone did pay a little bit more than everyone else for its chunk for whatever reason.
A tiny bit.
But
it's
the only
much
evidence of there being anything other than just a fixed price list.
Yeah, and we all knew that the ideal outcome, you don't want an auction, people go into it and you could get a mystery winner emerging and other people lose out, and that's how Sotheby's wants to run an auction, for instance. You don't want something like that
they're designed to maximise the amount of money.
Yeah, you just want four companies picking up licences, being able to, have a sort of fair and level playing field and not spending so much that they can't roll out the networks, which actually is kind of what they said happened when 3G got awarded. It was, there was so much spent that it slowed down network rollout. And that's enough. If the government's going on about how important connectivity is.
Exactly.
And
that's the point. Why fleece
the operators
for
1.4 billion?
Then do everything you can to make it easy.
And people say, this is one argument that people make when they say, well, we need auctions because if they didn't spend the money, they wouldn't spend the money on network rollout anyway. It would just go in dividends to shareholders. No, it wouldn't, because what you do is you attach more stringent obligations to the rollout, and you say, instead of these pathetic little fines that they give for not meeting a coverage obligation, you say, well, if you don't meet that coverage obligation, then you get an auction-like fee as your fine, but you don't do it up front, and therefore the company has the opportunity to use that money for network rollout. Everyone's a winner because it's useful for the economy, and they're not pumping huge amounts of money just into thin air.
Yeah, totally, 100%. I don't think there's any. Yeah, some people in the comments went, well, it wasn't too much, and someone even used data like you use, which is the price per megahertz per population, and that's fine. The fact that it wasn't as much of a skank as other auctions.
Yeah, it wasn't. It was low,
doesn't mean
but
it's
still
doesn't. Not a skank.
That, exactly. Just it was still a lot of money. And you add it to the previous 5G auction, and you're still looking at, what is it, 1.4? Yeah, 2.8. It's almost 3 billion they've spent on 5G spectrum. For companies that are, not doing great in a pandemic, not doing badly, but not doing great, I just think it's wrong.
So I think we've got time for my little extra, which is also to do with sort of state poking its nose into telecoms. But this is specifically the matter of net neutrality. And the only reason I'm bringing it up is because there's a law that just got passed in California that basically says it's a net neutrality law. It's called the Internet Consumer Protection and Net Neutrality Act. And here's verbatim what it says. The Act will prohibit, among other things, blocking lawful content, application services, or non-harmful devices, whatever they are, impairing or degrading lawful internet traffic on the basis of internet content, application, or service, or use of a non-harmful device, and specified practices related to zero rating. Now, all the stuff prior to zero rating is like to do with things like censorship and that sort of thing, which I completely agree. And I couldn't resist pointing out, given this is a Californian law, that that ridiculous thing I flagged up on the pod before of those two members of Congress trying to hassle providers into censoring Fox News and right-wing outlets they don't like. Well, this Californian law seems to explicitly prohibit exactly what those two idiots were suggesting. So that's good. But then you get onto zero rating. Zero rating basically means not charging for the traffic. So most traffic is metered, yeah?
Yeah.
So basically, to distill it down, because I did a bit of reading about it, people who think zero rating should be part of the net neutrality debate, in fact, it's helpful also to come up with a net neutrality definition, which I got from Investopedia. It defines it as the concept that all data on the internet should be treated equally by corporations such as internet service providers and governments, regardless of content, user, platform, application, or device. Now, I've always taken that to mean sort of data rates, i.e. no matter what the data is, if I'm getting 20 megabits per second on my phone or my broadband, then that data should come through at 20 megabits per second, whether it's Netflix or whether it's just Joe Blog's blog.
Yeah, but it could also mean a usage allocation, can't it? Because if you have Deezer or something, and your provider says that doesn't count against your 10 gigabytes that you get a month, but this other music service does, then you've automatically given a kind of network advantage to one company.
Well, that's it. That's the counter argument, which I must admit, I'm surprised to hear from you. But
I'm not saying I agree with it. Saying that's where the argument
is. Yeah, so that is the counter argument. And, you know, if technically you could say that, yes, you are then being prejudicial against that data that you still charge for.
Yeah.
But I still think, so my point of view, having thought about it, and I've got some sympathy for that, you know, by the letter of the law, yes, it is, especially if you're in skint markets. You know, if you're in Africa or something and you're saying you can have WhatsApp for free but not Signal, then you're kind of coercing, you're kind of distorting the market in favor of WhatsApp over Signal, aren't you?
Yeah.
But the flip side of it for me, and the one I still find more compelling as a instinctively sort of laissez-faire, hands-off person, is I think there should be net neutrality in terms of not affecting data rates. Although it should be noted.
See, that you still I don't get even to... agree with that.
Okay, fair enough. And one caveat I'll put for that is that you're still allowed to pay for different data rates at the point of purchase.
Yeah, and also, I mean, It's a hysterical issue, but companies, I mean, you could extend it beyond this. You could say that any kind of tie-up between a network operator and an over-the-top player, which might just be that, you know, it might not be something to do with the network side of things. It might be some other kind of agreement where there's some kind of joint marketing. That hands an advantage to that company over its rivals in a way, because it means that customers on that network are drawn to that particular provider.
Yeah.
So, and this sort of stuff goes on outside.
Companies
do deals with each other. They have tie-ups. Yeah. So
you can argue that a company that can outspend everyone else on advertising gets to distort the market.
I just find it a very weird topic, and I don't think it's the reason that that certain internet companies have emerged and are much more powerful than others, and no one else gets a look in. I think that's a totally different issue. That's all to do with network effects and research and development spending and all sorts of things.
We don't use Google because we get bit rate.
No. And the other thing I would say is on the rate side, I mean, if they don't, and this is interesting because I think it came up in the UK recently, actually. I think Mark Allera wrote a letter, didn't he, to Ofcom, I think, in the last couple of weeks.
Yes, you're
arguing
right.
Against that. If they don't allow this to happen, then 5G network slicing isn't going to happen. because that's what 5G network slicing
it's
is.
About,
5G network slicing is different categories of service
different over, the, types of stuff over the internet. Over the
yeah, it's giving priority service, a low latency service, for instance, to you know a factory or whatever, you know, which could run on the public network, you know, and you give a low latency service to them. You carve out a bit, and you have your other traffic going over the over a sort of you know more mainstream pipe that's lower cost, and then you might have one that's a massive massive sort of megabyte per second service for video. That's all network slicing basically. So yeah. If they're not going to allow it, then network slicing isn't going to work, is it?
Exactly. Another point about zero rating is that you can buy uncapped packages, so everything is zero rated.
Exactly.
But no one's saying that you shouldn't be able to offer uncapped tariffs.
What I don't think they should be able to do is I don't think you should be able to have it so that if you're in one of these slow lanes, for instance, compared with your super duper, I'm going to pay a bit extra, you should have some kind of minimum, like a floor, where you're guaranteed a certain service. Now, I don't know how easy that is to do, but you don't want people being degraded on their service because someone's had a higher priority one. You know, you don't want people suffering and not being able to access the internet at all, let's say.
Yes, and the particular That's matter bad. With AT&T, why it was a big deal for them is they've obviously shelled out all this cash on buying Time Warner, which includes HBO, right. And they've got a streaming service called HBO Max. And AT&T was zero rating HBO Max, but not Netflix and Amazon and all that stuff. Yeah. I actually think it's just a matter, again, this is a classic sort of free marketeer approach. I think it's just a matter of transparency. You know, my concluding paragraph of my piece was, while there is some merit in the latter position, that's referring to the, you know, to the point, to the people who are more into state intervention. On balance, we prefer pricing. I've got that journalistic thing of saying we, as if we'd had a big editorial meeting about it.
Like the Queen.
Yeah, as if there was some sort of editorial board and we come to a consensus on the matter, rather than me just sitting here in this very shitty office that you can see behind me. So on balance, we would prefer pricing to be kept out of the net neutrality debate. So long as all data is treated equally with respect to delivery and censorship, providers should be able to charge what they want for that delivery and answer to their customers accordingly. But then I did put this caveat at the end. In the US, however, where there is very limited CSP competition in many areas, the free market proposition is somewhat undermined.
That's the problem, I think. And that's how you deal with, you know, if you've got a company, the thing that I think is bad about, you know, where abuse can happen is if someone's actually blocked. And that has happened before, I think, in the US in the past. And that's how I think it came to light in the first place, the whole term. There were court cases, I think, over internet providers actually blocking voice over IP applications on the network because they saw it as a threat to their own kind of voice revenues. Now that sort of thing,
you can imagine it like 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah, you can imagine it 10, 20 years. It'd be very unlikely now, but if that sort of thing, if they're actually blocking an application on the ground, certainly on some grounds that it competes against their own services, now that's when I think you need to have. But existing laws seem to be able to deal with that anyway. You don't need a new net neutrality law. And well, I think the problem with the US is, as you just said, you know, if anybody tries to do that sort of thing, you know, consumers are at some point, they're going to go, if it's a service people want, they're going to go, well, hang on a minute, I'm not particularly happy about my ISP.
As long as you've got choice.
I'm going to go and get another one. So if you've got choice, if you've got network competition, it should never really be an issue. But unfortunately, as you've just pointed out, in some parts of the US, you apparently only have one, you know, one broadband provider, which is ridiculous, you know, that they have a situation where you can't get, you know, anybody else apart from Comcast or whoever it might be.
But, yes.
But yeah, it's a hysterical issue and a really silly one, I think.
Well, it is a hysterical issue, and that's a point I make in it. Like there's so much in the States, and I'm sure when I make this generalization, Americans get annoyed at me saying it, but it's still true. Sorry, Yanks.
It's one thing or the other. There's no
middle ground. Yeah, everything's polarized and everything's politicized. So the people in favor of net neutrality are the people who are generally in favor of big state intervention. They're egalitarians. They don't want anything to be unfair.
Yeah, they're the sort of people who go to protests waving around placards.
Maybe.
Which is true. They have net neutrality protests. It happened quite a lot in the last few years.
Well, everything is this sort of feeble little sort of parody of 60s civil rights activism. And everything can have a little chant and a slogan attached to it. And I just think that's where I agree with you. It's become hysterical. They're turning it into a sort of a moral thing.
Yeah.
Whereas it's really just a matter of business terms and conditions. And the only area in which it's arguably moral is if companies are able to do this with no transparency and there's no recourse for the consumer to protect themselves from sort of anti-competitive behavior. If it's either a CSP trying to block OTT stuff because it directly challenges them, or a CSP trying to favor stuff that they've bought through M&A over stuff they haven't. But as you say, most anti-competition law already covers that. And transparency, in any case, should allow consumers to go, hold on a sec, I don't like the fact that I can watch HBO Max just fine on AT&T, but when I try and watch Disney Plus, it crawls to a halt.
The other stupid thing about it, I think, on the politics side, is that it's one of these tit for tat issues because it's you know, it's seen as a, you know, if you're a Republican, then you are sort of anti net neutrality, and if you're a Democrat, then you believe in legislation. It's one of those things that just gets changed every time there's a new administration that comes in.
So the FCC.
We had Tom Wheeler with all these sort of pro net neutrality things, and then Ajit Pai comes along and gets rid of it all, and now we're going to get, you know, whoever it is, I don't know who the new FCC commissioner is going to be.
Well, but it's still Rosenworcel.
She's the acting one, isn't she? Yeah. But we'll get it reintroduced under the new regime, and then it'll get torn down again in the future.
Well,
and it's a sad thing about
the nature of
American politics at the moment, unfortunately, is that it's...
Well, and particularly sad thing about politicising stuff that shouldn't be political at the FCC.
Yeah.
And the thing is, FTC, I wrote a story, actually I screwed up, and we'll be about to stop because we're overrunning. But I screwed up. There was an appointee to the FTC.
Right.
For some
reason,
the whole
time. Federal Trade Commission.
Yeah, Federal Trade, which is analogous to the FCC, but more general.
Yeah.
Less sort of vertically focused. And for some reason, the whole time I was reading it and writing it up, I just read FCC. And so I wrote it as FCC. And then someone in the comments went, FTC. And I thought, Jesus Christ, I've written this whole thing about the wrong organization. It was just the weirdest brain fart. I guess I was just so sort of tunnel visioned on it being an FCC thing.
Yeah.
It's funny how the brain works that I just didn't even acknowledge that letter difference. Anyway, I mean, it's still a relevant story. It wasn't like I completely got it wrong. It's just a different bureaucratic organization. Yeah. But the person they brought in there is someone who has basically dedicated her whole life to trust busting big internet companies.
Right.
So that'll be an interesting one. And she's obviously a Democrat, because the Democrats, it's like picking football teams when you're at primary school, isn't it? They get to pick their team now.
Yeah.
And I just think that's a real shame. I mean, I suppose, you know, I'm just trying to think, Ofcom, no one ever talks about the political affiliation of appointees to Ofcom.
No, it's not politicised in the same way.
So why is the FCC? I don't get it.
And I don't think
just
most
the way the US
regulators
is.
Are. Yeah.
Right, okay. Well, we better leave it at that. And by the way, I still think America's great. Any America's listeners who think I'm having a general pop, I'm not. I just think you could all just do with taking it down a notch every now and then. That's all. Cool. All right. Well, and thanks for listening. Hopefully Americans will keep listening. And make sure you join us for the next one.